Conference record has joined the conference.
Hello, this is Heather Vancura. Welcome to the JCP Spec Lead call on developing a TCK. Today we have two guest speakers, so I'm going to be turning it over to our guest speakers, and then at the end of the call we will have time for a few questions. So I'm going to introduce our speakers. We have Patrick Curran, who is the chair of the JCP, and also Steve Caruso, who is a senior manager at Oracle, working with the TCK development tools. Welcome and thank you. I will turn it over to Patrick, who has the materials ready to go now, which are available on jcp.org as well on the multimedia page.
Okay. Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, everybody. I'm Patrick Curran. If you're not logged on to WebEx, I encourage you to do so because then you can follow along directly. I will read out the slide numbers as we go through this. I'm chair of the JCP, which is a job I've been doing for several years, but you may not know that before that I used to run the development team inside Sun that was responsible for developing the TCK for Java SE. So TCK development is a subject near and dear to my heart, and I thought it was time to kind of share a little of that with you. Steve Caruso, who's with us, still is the person responsible for developing the TCK for Java EE. So between the two of us, hopefully we can answer any questions you may have about what's involved in TCK development. Thanks for joining us, Steve.
Thank you for having me.
I don't think we have anyone else from the JCK team, but I can certainly play that role since, as I said, I used to manage that team. Okay, so let's move on. I'm going on to slide two, just a quick overview of the agenda. So we'll talk about what the deliverables of the JSR process are and what the obligations of the spec lead are under the process document, which is the official specification, if you like, for how JSR should be developed. We'll then talk about the process of conformance or compatibility testing, what makes a good specification, what a TCK should contain. We'll talk about compatibility requirements, how over and above purely testing you can make sure that people who implement your specification actually do so in a compatible manner. We'll talk about the qualities of good TCK, how you decide what to test and what not to test, how you measure your level of coverage, how you test the TCK, and how you can allow others to basically to report bugs against the TCK. There's a lot of material here. It's going to be covered fairly quickly as a fairly high level, but we're in the process, as I will say, towards the end of trying to improve our resources and materials that we make available to you. So I'll introduce those at the end. So moving on, slide three. You've probably seen this slide before. It's just a reminder that you have, as a spec lead, responsibility to deliver three things, not just one or two. We all know about the spec. Most of us know about the reference implementation, but you also have to build a TCK, which stands for Technology Compatibility Kit, which is basically a set of tests. Sometimes people would call this a conformance test suite that can be used to verify that the implementation of a specification conforms to what the specification requires. And as you build each of them kind of helps you to build the other. The process of creating the reference implementation helps you to demonstrate that the spec is actually realistic and feasible and can be implemented in the real world. The process of developing the tests will flesh out problems in the specification, because if you find language that's ambiguous or something that's missing, you won't be able to write a test. The process of running the tests against the reference implementation will find some problems in the TCK and the tests themselves. You'll find buggy tests, and you'll find bugs in the reference implementation. So each of them supports the other. Okay, slide four. You probably know that TCKs are required. You may not know that that the recent version of the process document, which is the document that describes how you must do your work, in version 2.8, we actually increased the requirements around TCKs. And this is what the process document itself says about the TCK that you must deliver. You must include documentation. Sounds obvious, but people don't do a very good job of this. must tell the users of the TCK how they can run it, how they should interpret the test results. You must include what we call compatibility requirements, and I'll say more about this later. These are requirements that explain what your implementers must do over and above to passing the tests to be compatible. More on that later. You must provide a means for running the tests automatically. It's not enough just to have a whole bunch of tests. Go off and run these. Unless you have a repeatable, simple, automated way of running them, there's no way that your users are actually going to be able to make sense of their test results. You must provide a means to allow the users of your test suite to tell you if they think there is a bug in one of your tests, and that happens more often than you might think. You must make sure that all of the APIs that your specification defines are completely and correctly implemented within an implementation, and that there are no additional APIs included in the namespace of that JSR. So in other words, what people implement must be exactly what you specify, no more and no less. And you must provide what we call a TCK coverage document, which is a document that explains how you measured the quality and the level of coverage of your TCK, and that gives information that will allow the executive committee who will review your TCK on the final ballot to judge its overall level of quality and to decide whether it is good enough. So we didn't mandate exactly how you should measure coverage, but we say you must tell us how you did and explain to us why you believe that your TCK is of decent quality. So I'll go into each of these in more detail as we go through this. Slide 5. Let's start with conformance testing, or testing for compatibility. And how is that different from the other kind of testing that you're much more used to, such as unit testing or general QA testing or whatever? Excuse me. Well, first point is that it may sound weird, but as a conformance tester, it's not your job to worry about performance, about efficiency, about usability, security, robustness, or even quality, unless the spec explicitly has requirements in those areas. And usually specs don't, because these are usually a matter of quality of implementation. So, a reminder again, it's not your job to test for quality. I sometimes say, if the spec is a bad spec and it calls for a rotten implementation, then it is your job to verify that the implementation is exactly as rotten as the spec requires it to be. That's your job. Now, hopefully, in the process of developing your TCK, you will say, this isn't a very good spec, and you will provide feedback to the spec authors, and they will fix it. But if that doesn't happen, it's your job to verify that the reference that the implementation is bad in the way that the spec says it should be. Your TCK is going to have to run in all sorts of environments. Don't assume that the environment in which you develop it is the environment you're going to run it in. So if you're a Linux user, you build your TCK under Linux. Remember that it's quite likely that people are going to be running it under Windows or under any number of other operating systems. And you're not allowed to poke around inside the implementation and say, it's obvious from this what the implementers were intending, so I'm going to test for that. You only can go by what's written down. So think of that as black box testing only, no white box testing, no poking around inside. Okay, next slide, slide 6. I mentioned that the process of developing tests can significantly help to improve the quality of the spec. So this applies, of course, only if you start early enough while the spec is still under development. But you will find problems. As you actually read the specification and try to write a test, you will say, it's not clear to me what this particular section means, or this appears to contradict that section. So you'll find problems, report them back, get them fixed. From the specification's perspective, what is really important is that things are actually specified. Duh. If something is left unspecified, or if it's left vague, or if it's left implementation specific, in other words, up to the implementer, you can't test it. So requirements in very specific, explicit language are important. RFC 2119, very old RFC, explicitly talks about the words that should be used in writing specifications. Words like must and shall not are good. Those are explicit. You know what to do with them. If a spec says may, should, do what you like, or doesn't say anything on the assumption that it's obvious what you should do, that's bad, because you cannot test. You can only test to what is written. And it's okay to have portions of your spec that are optional. In other words, you can say something like, it is not necessary to implement this feature, but if you do, here is how it should be implemented. If a spec is written in that way, you can write tests for them, but you should be aware that the more optional functionality, the more optional areas there are in a specification, the less you have write once, run anywhere, because effectively developers will never know when they're running on a particular implementation whether it contains optional feature X or not. And what tends to happen under these circumstances is that people write to the lowest common denominator. They write to only the required portions of the spec, and those fancy little optional features that you are so proud of are not going to get used. So to the extent possible, avoid optional functionality in a spec. So all of these are things that you'll be looking out for as you're actually trying to develop tests. Next slide, slide 7. We've sort of touched on most of these, but as a reminder, a TCK is more than a set of tests. You know, if you build a whole bunch of good tests, throw them in a directory or a zip file, throw them over the wall, that's not a TCK. It's a bunch of tests. In addition to the tests, which you should be providing in source form as well as binary form, because in source form it's easier for people to debug problems, you need to provide, as I've said, documentation. You need to provide an automation harness of some kind. You need to define these compatibility requirements. You need to define a test appeals process. And related to that, you need to provide some kind of mechanism to allow the exclusion of certain tests which you may have distributed but you've later discovered due to an appeals process are buggy. So you need a mechanism for excluding them from the automated running of tests. Just a quick check-in. Can people still hear me? Somebody say yes?
Yes.
Good. Thank you. Okay. Section 8, slide 8, compatibility requirements. That's very musical. Thank you. Okay, so compatibility requirements, this is kind of a complicated subject, and I'm not going to be able to go into it in full detail, but the essence of it is that simply passing tests is not enough. There are going to be some things that you are unable to test. There are going to be some things that you do not test, because to test any real-world implementation of any reasonably complex specification 100% is effectively impossible. The number of combinations and variations is such that no matter what resources you throw at it, you're not going to be able to do anything, and it is not in fact feasible to do so. So there's going to be areas that are not tested. So that's why we have these compatibility requirements, and the very first one of these that I say here, and this is called out in the process document, at a minimum, your compatibility requirements must include this statement. Your implementation must fully implement the specification, including all required interfaces and functionality, whether or not there are tests. That's my point, okay? When I ran the JCK team, I'd forever have people coming up to me and saying things like, I know my implementation is not going to be able to pass the tests in this particular area, but I know the JCK doesn't have any tests in that area, so I'm all right, right? And I'd say, no, you're not. Doesn't matter whether we have tests, you have an obligation to fully implement the spec. And the second half of this we already touched on, you know, you mustn't modify the namespace. You've got to implement everything, no more, no less. No supersetting, no subsetting. Now, compatibility requirements typically contain many, many other things. And if you look at the requirements, for example, for the JCK, you'll find something like 15 pages of detailed, semi-legalistic, very technical data saying you must do this, and under these circumstances, you must do that. A couple of the simpler ones that we have, and we have examples of these which I'll point you to later, an important rule is you must be able to pass all the tests in all configurations of your implementation. Configuration means if you have startup flags, if there are environment variables you read, if there are different modes or switches or whatever, every combination of those modes and configurations, you must be able to pass the test. That's because we don't want bait and switch. We don't want people releasing an implementation of a spec that has one mode where it's fully compatible and then other modes where it runs extra fast, but it's incompatible. We want people who run on top of Java implementations to always know what they're getting. a second and perhaps obvious additional compatibility requirement is, you know, run the tests as we provide them. Don't mess around with them. Don't modify them. Don't screw around with the test harness. Just run it as we specify. And there are many more. Okay, slide nine. If you're looking at a TCK and trying to decide whether it's good quality, how do you decide? Or if you're trying to build one, how do you work to make sure it's the highest possible quality? It's not just the number of tests. It's not just being able to say, I've got high coverage. Because as I said, you're not going to be able to cover everything. So, and I'll say more about this later, it's almost as important or maybe more important to decide what you're not going to test than it is to decide what you are going to test. You should be focusing your tests where they're going to get the biggest bang for the buck, where it's most important, and that means more on that later. Your tests are going to be correct. There's no point in having a lot of tests if they're buggy. They've got to be efficient. They've got to be portable. They've got to run in all environments. They've got to be well documented. They've got to be maintainable. It all sounds, you know, sounding mother and apple pie, but the important point, I guess, is that you've got to treat the TCK like a product, and it has to be of high quality in the same way that you want your product or your implementation to be of high quality. Slide 10. Okay, as I said, the spec is non-trivial. You can't completely test it. You just will not have the resources. Therefore, you've got to decide what to leave out. You should be focusing not on the trivial stuff. If you have an API that says, you know, if I pass in a parameter out of this range, it's going to throw an exception of so-and-so. Well, you know, my TCK developers would often start with stuff like that because it's simple, it's easy, you know you can write a test for it. But guess what? A test probably isn't going to do you a great deal because that is the kind of bug that any half-conscious developer is not going to introduce in the first place, and any half-conscious unit tester is going to catch. You need to be focusing, to the extent that you have to focus, on the more complex and the more subtle areas. Focus where the risk of an incompatibility is the greatest. That means where the implementation is difficult, not trivial, like the example I just gave, and where implementers may even have an incentive to tweak their code or to cheat. For example, if there's an area of the spec where if it's not implemented exactly as written, an implementation is going to go faster, that's an area to watch out for because people may be tempted, consciously or unconsciously, to break that requirement. Focus where the consequences of an incompatibility are the greatest, where there may be a security breach or applications would just plain old fail to run. And focus where you get the biggest bang for the buck. Focus on fundamental classes, on mainline code, rather than obscure corner cases and so on and so on. Okay. Excuse me. Slide 11. Measuring coverage. We could do a whole hour on this, and maybe sometime we will, but let me try and cover it in 3 or 4 minutes. How do you measure coverage? Here's how we did it at Sun, how we do it at Oracle today, and how several of us, as part of the TCK team, worked through W3C and later through OASIS to kind of push out these ideas into the broader conformance testing world. You work through a process of what we call identifying test assertions. A test assertion is a normative requirement or statement within the specification. So I'll give you a couple of examples here. The text that is quoted here from Java SE APIs are specific statements of requirements. It is a normative statement. If this, then that. If you identify all of these statements within the specification, in theory, you ought to be able to test it. You ought to be able to test for each of these. To measure how good your coverage is, you can parcel or divide up the spec into different areas. If it's API-based classes and methods are the obvious way to do it. If it's a different kind of spec, maybe by functional area of the specification or perhaps even by chapter and page. It really doesn't matter that much. For each area, in each of these areas, you're going to identify a certain number of test assertions. Then you want to measure how many of those assertions in each of these areas are actually covered at all. So if you have a class and if there are 100 assertions you identify and you have a test for 70 of them, then you would claim you have 70% assertion coverage. But I want to distinguish between what I call breadth coverage and depth coverage. I said if you have at least one test for an assertion, you can count that as covered in some sense. However, certain assertions may need not just one test, but 10 or 15 or 20. And there are certain statements within, for example, the Java language specification, where I would argue that they are so complex that the number of tests required to thoroughly test them may be as much as 100. So if you have, hypothetically, an assertion which, if you were to thoroughly test it, you would have 10 tests or 10 test cases, and you write only 5, then what I call the depth coverage, the extent to which you've covered that area, is only 50%, because you wrote half as many tests as you should have done. So the first of these metrics, breadth, is objective. That's easy to measure. Assuming that you've identified your assertions, you can count them and do the math. When it comes to depth, it's more subjective. How many tests would I need to test this? So if you're going to measure that, it's really more of an estimate than a measure. But you really need to focus on both of these numbers, and here's why. If you claim 70% assertion breadth coverage, what you're saying is, of all the assertions in my spec, 70% of them are tested in some way. But to say you have 70% coverage is grossly misleading, because if, in effect, you needed on average 10 tests for each of those assertions and you wrote only 5, your depth coverage is only 50%. So your true level of coverage, the extent to which you completely test that particular area, is 70% times 50%, that is approximately one-third. In other words, two-thirds of everything that could be tested is not tested. So that's a very high-level introduction to how you can measure and estimate coverage, and remember, we require a test coverage document. We require you to provide a document that says, this is how I calculated my level of coverage, and this is what I came up with. Okay, how would you go about this process? Slide 12. So we call the process specification markup. So you go through the spec. Simplest way to do that, say, just take a paper copy and use a yellow marker or whatever. There are various tools that you may be able to obtain or build that would allow you to do this. But what you want to do is identify the assertions in the spec. If you're starting this early enough, then this is great, because this is the point at which you can provide feedback to the spec lead and say, or to the expert group who's developing the spec, and say, you know, this language is fuzzy over here. I thought this was actually a definitive normative statement, but when you look at it, it kind of says should instead of must, so I can't test it. Please fix that. Ideally, this is a virtuous circle. Ideally, you provide the list of assertions to the spec lead, and the spec lead signs off on it and approves it, and you go around it. That way, you all have agreement on what it is that needs to be tested. If you do this, you're going to get a much better quality spec than if you don't do this. As I've said, you're going to need to provide a coverage report which explains what you've covered and what you haven't and where you're strong and where you're not. And this will help implementers who are running your test to know where they can really rely on the TCK and say, I know it's going to do a good job testing over here, and where they can't really rely on it so much because, as I suggested, there may be areas where you're only testing one-third of everything that could be tested. Tell them, because that way they know what they can trust and what they don't. And, of course, if you do all of this process, given that you are, I hope, making a long-term commitment, not just to release this TCK once, but to maintain it over time, you know where your problem areas are, you know where it's best for you to focus next, and build the next set of tests in the next release. Okay, slide 13. You've got to test your TCK. And the process of testing it, you've got to remember, it's not your job test the reference implementation. That'll be what you're testing it against or what you're running it against. But you're doing that in order to test the TCK and to find problems in the TCK. If you find problems in the implementation, that's a bonus. The spec lead should be thanking you for that. They will. They'll be very glad that you find problems. But it's your job primarily as a TCK developer to find bugs in the TCK. What this means is that if you run the TCK against the implementation, and all the tests pass, that is bad, okay? Maybe good for the reference implementation. The spec lead may pat himself on the back and say, we did a great job in building the RI, but you don't know that because it may be that your tests are rubbish. But if all the tests pass, that tells you nothing or very little about the quality of your TCK. How do you know that the TCK would have found or will find bugs in implementations? You don't know that unless you actually exercise those negative code paths, unless it actually fails. So you've got to make it fail. You may actually have to inject errors into the implementation in order to force the TCK to fail, in order to demonstrate that your logic that says if it does this, then pass, and if it does that, then fails, in order to demonstrate that logic is actually good. And this is a really difficult one, you know, you've got to try and figure out and assure yourself that your TCK is going to provide useful results, not on the implementation that you're testing it with, but on implementations that do not yet exist. And this is, in my experience, after 20 years of doing testing, is almost unique, because almost every time you are a test developer, you're given a specification in the form of, this is what the product is supposed to do, and these are the implementations it's going to run on. You know, we support it on Windows X and on Linux Y and on, you know, Unix Z or whatever. But in the case of TCKs, the implementations that this thing is going to run on don't yet exist at all. I mean, you could say hypothetically, oh, it must run on the JVM, but that's so vague a statement. That's like saying an application must run on an operating system. So you're in the weird situation of trying to verify that your tests are good, trying to verify that the product that you're going to ship, which is a TCK, is going to run and perform successfully on platforms, implementations that you have never heard of and that may not even exist today. 2 years down the road, there may be a new VM that doesn't exist today, and your TCK is going to have to run on it. This is really tough stuff. So testing the TCK takes a significant amount of effort, maybe almost as much. We always say, you know, from a development perspective, you should be spending as much on testing as you're spending on developing. Well, we're getting a little recursive here, but, you know, the tests themselves are a product, and it's probably going to cost you as much to test the tests as it does to develop them. Okay. Slide 14. We're almost done here. Your test may be buggy. We're not perfect. Sometimes we introduce bugs into our test. You have to define, this is another obligation under the process, you have to define an appeals process that will enable implementers who are running your TCK to come to you and say, this test is buggy. Typical reasons they may say that, typical justifications they may provide, include, not necessarily limited to, but these are the main ones, the test itself is buggy. It contains a logic error, or the person who wrote it misread the spec, and, you know, it's not supposed to be testing what it is testing. So that's one kind of bug. You may have a bug because the spec itself is buggy. You may have a test that runs correctly, but in a sense it's misinterpreting the spec, because the spec is perhaps has contradictory requirements. In one area of the spec it says if A then B, in another area of the spec it says if A then C. The testers wrote tests for both of those requirements, but they can't both be fulfilled at the same time. So that would be another ground for issuing a challenge to a test, or in that case a pair of tests. One of them must be wrong. And another area where we have problems, and this goes back to what I was saying a moment ago, you only have one implementation typically to test against, but you're going to be running against other implementations later. Your test may be subtly, unconsciously biased towards the particular implementation that you're using to do test development and to test your tests. We, with the JCK, used to run into this all the time. We'd develop our tests on Windows, we'd run them on Linux and Solaris and Windows, but then we'd give the test to IBM and run them on EBCDIC machines, which are completely different architecture, and guess what? You know, some of them would fail because we had unconsciously and unwittingly introduced biases that caused those tests not to run on an EBCDIC machine. So you may have tests that are biased towards a particular implementation, which in practice means either your implementation or common implementations as opposed to uncommon. Maybe your tests will always work on big engine machines and fail on little engine machines, for example. You have to define a formal process to allow implementers to challenge your tests. You have to investigate these claims, and you have to provide remediation. If you agree with them, then you have to provide a mechanism that will exclude those tests from being executed. So if you had an automated test suite that would automatically run 50,000 tests and you find that five of them are buggy, one option is to re-release the entire test suite, and that you're always free to do that, but it's better if you have a way of, in the field, excluding those particular tests from the test run. Now, this doesn't have to be an automated mechanism. It's okay to simply say, we have found that tests 3, 5, and 97 are buggy, and it is okay for you to fail them when you review your test results. But better to automate that process, and we use a process we call an exclude list. So it's like the automation process, the test script or whatever, will run through every test it finds, but will skip over tests that it finds listed in this particular list. If you exclude tests, you're certainly free to provide corrected tests that do the right thing, and you can do these as an add-on, or you can actually update the entire test suite. You're not obliged to do that. It's entirely up to you. But if the tests that you end up excluding would significantly weaken the TCK if they are testing fundamental central functionality, then it's probably a good idea for you to provide alternate tests in one form or another. Okay, that's the test challenge process. Okay, so that's my high-level how long was that? Like 35 minutes summary of multiple years of experience in developing TCKs. We've tried to write down this stuff in the Spec Lead guide. We've just started updating this, so bear with me. Let me pull that up. So the Spec Lead guide, if you guys aren't familiar with it, you should be. I guess it's linked from the home page. Oh, I don't want to go to my bank. I want to go to jcp.org. So you go to the home page, you'll see over here, quick links, Spec Lead guide. That will bring you to this page. You scroll down, and you've got a whole bunch of stuff here, but you'll see a section called Developing TCKs. And I just updated this last week, and if you read it, you'll see it's pretty similar to what I've just talked about. That's not a surprise, because basically what I did was to take this set of slides and to turn them into prose and write them down here. But I've done it because it's in HTML form, so we do have links here to additional materials that we provide. So I link where I have further explanation. So, for example, here we talk about your obligations and what you're supposed to provide. So I link to the various sections where I define these in more detail. Let me touch on one because I didn't go into that in detail. I didn't use this term. I talked about you have an obligation to include in your compatibility requirements the requirement that all APIs must be present exactly as written, no subsetting, no supersetting. The formal definition for that is 100% signature test coverage. So let me say just a little bit more about that. So signature testing is a process of testing that the signatures, the calling parameters and the return types and any exception thrown for any APIs that you specify, it's a way of verifying that the implementation actually matches what it's supposed to match. And some developed Oracle is still releasing a test called a signature test that will allow you to do exactly that. And this is free. You can get it from the next page. It's linked directly from here or via the next page, but I'll come to that in a moment. So we have a number of tools and documentation. So I skip down to the bottom here for more information on this next page that I'm going to go to in a moment. So additional documentation on this stuff and some tools to help you in the process of developing TCKs. It occurs to me right now that much of what I've said is probably Java SE specific. I'm not that familiar with Java EE testing, and maybe Steve can jump in a little while and say whether there's additional stuff in that area that varies from the way we do stuff in Java SE. And again, Java NE, of course, is different again. But the overall principles apply, you know, what is a good quality TCK. So these resource materials, I guess, let me give a caveat here. These materials that we're talking about, much of this stuff was developed several years ago, released in fact back in 2006 when I was actually still responsible for the TCK tools team who actually did this work. Since then, much of it has not been supported. Some of the stuff is now developed in open source projects, but the core materials, the documents themselves, have not been updated since then, which is unfortunate, but there's still useful stuff there. But anyway, let me run through what we have available. So first of all, there's a test harness. Anyone who has run any Sun or Oracle TCK will probably know that they're all using the same test harness that we call Java Test. That's now available in open source. It is a very powerful, very flexible, but unfortunately very complicated test harness. You may find it overkill. You probably will find it overkill for anything but the largest TCKs that you develop. But nevertheless, it's there. If you want a really powerful test harness, it's very fully documented. It can be configured to do just about anything you want to do. It does things like it can run on one machine and execute tests on another machine. It's programmable and scriptable and on and on and on. So that's available, fully supported, documented. Each of these open source projects I'm talking about has a Java.NET project. Java.NET's a little slow as always, but you can get there. So there's that. More importantly, and something you should be grabbing, is SigTest, which is the tool that I talked about that allows you to verify that the signatures of your implementation do what they're supposed to do. It's basically a way of saying, I will give a reference implementation which I know is correct, and I want to be able to compare another implementation to it and see if it has all the right signatures. This tool will generate from your own implementation a file containing the signature specifications, and then it will go off and you can run it on another implementation. It'll say, this one's missing, this one's changed, and there's something here that shouldn't be here. Really useful. Fully documented, free, so go grab that one. If you're doing Java ME-related stuff, there is a Java ME framework, which, again, has all sorts of bells and whistles, particularly to deal with the fact that you, in the ME world, you may be dealing with a resource-constrained device that doesn't have all the capabilities of the full system, and you may need to execute tests remotely, and so on and so on. Documentation. Okay, here's where I say these are legacy documents. And unfortunately, they describe how Sun used to do things and how Oracle now does it. They do reference the tools that Sun uses, for example, Java Test. They're heavily referenced in here, and you may well not want to use Java Test because it's probably overkill for you. SpecTrack is a tool that we use internally for measuring coverage, for doing specification markup, which is not yet available outside. So if you're going to use these documents, you have to read them carefully because there's bits of them that will just not apply to you. But they're still the kind of stuff that I've talked about in this talk. These documents go into that kind of stuff in considerably more detail and will provide you with some good background. So there's stuff about, you know, coverage and planning your test development process. So how to plan a test development project. You know, we're doing detailed stuff here. This is how many pages? 80 pages of documentation, test appeals process, and so on and so on. Test suite development guide, this is particularly useful because it'll talk about, particularly in the API area, some techniques for developing tests, how to decide exactly what test cases you need, and so on. And again, this is pretty detailed and complex, and I would say probably about two-thirds of this is not related to some specific tools. You're talking how much? 135 pages of documentation. There is a template for developing your documentation for your TCK user's guide. This particular template is, again, probably overkill for you. As background, it will be useful, but it does make certain assumptions. It assumes you're going to be using Java Test, for example. So it's probably more complicated than you need. Instead of that, we have derived from it a very simple user's guide template, which is so simple that it contains only one line of text. In other words, we're still working on it, but the intent is to take that complicated document, and strip it down so that it contains the bare minimum, a set of sample compatibility requirements that you should be including, certain definitions that you should be including, an example of a test appeals process, and stuff like that. We're working on that as we speak, and hopefully that'll be done in a few weeks' time. And finally, I should have said that this document refers to sample TCK tests, and those are available for download, so they kind of go together with this. That is simply a zip file with a bunch of test files in it. And we have a sample test coverage document, an example of the document that you need to provide when you submit your TCK for evaluation. So you could use this as a template. Define your terms, talk about what you mean by coverage in the sense that you are measuring it, explain the numbers that you came up with. I found 426 assertions that could be tested. I actually developed 304 tests, so I have 70% assertion breadth coverage. My depth coverage is approximately 50%, blah, blah, blah. It varies from 30% to 95%. We did focus in the critical area and had higher coverage there. Our method level of coverage, in other words, how many of the methods are actually covered. Signature coverage is 100%, and so on and so on. So these are the kind of numbers that we're going to be looking for you to provide. You can tell us what configurations you tested against, how you measured quality, and why you believe that your level of coverage and quality is decent. So there is a lot of material here. I apologize for the fact that some of it is out of date. We're resource constrained as ever, but we're doing our best to clean it up, simplify it, and we will continue to work on this. So that's what I have. I'm going to stop. I don't know if, Steve, you have anything to add. Is there anything from the Java EE side that we haven't touched on to the extent that we should have done here?
No, you touched on everything. That's a lot of information to cover in the 50 or so minutes that you had there. I mean, it could easily go, you know, another 2 or 3 hours to cover some of that in detail. One of the things that you touched on about our CTS, which is the TCK for Java EE platform, is in our test, because we have deployment and different things that have to run in different containers. Sometimes in our tests, we actually have to include like a client connection or client tools that everybody is required to run in order to test some of our end-to-end testing. For the JCK, side, there's not so much a need for that. But with EE, we do have extra things that are required in our test suite for you to install in order to run our test, and actually one of the tools we will actually run against is the RI itself to test your own implementation. So some of our tests require your vendor's implementation and the RI in order to complete the end-to-end test.
Because in fact in Java ME that's typically the case too, so I will add to the section what is in a typical TCK a statement to the effect that you, in many areas, you will be required to provide some kind of hook connection facility, interface code, or whatever that will permit the TCK to actually talk to or communicate with your implementation.
Correct. And I know it was a lot of information in a short amount of time, but the test assertion stuff that Patrick talked about is critical, and it's one of those things that I've seen as spec leads evolve their specs and keep revving it. It's one of the things that spec leads kind of pushes aside, and as a test person, you really got to push the spec leads to stay on top of that, because it's a critical part of your TCK.
Okay.
But other than that, Patrick, a lot of information that you passed out. I think it's a great slide deck.
Okay, good. Thanks. Going back to the assertion thing, I briefly mentioned, let me say in more detail, and this is something else that I intend to add to this collection of material. So I and a bunch of other people initiated an OASIS technical committee, which is the OASIS equivalent of a working group, of an expert group, excuse me, to create an OASIS, not exactly a specification. This was a technical note, but it was basically we put years of effort into defining the process of identifying assertions, defining what assertions are, writing guidelines for how to go through that process, defining an XML markup language for specifications, which unfortunately is more complex than I would have liked, but you always have to compromise in the process of developing stuff through a standards body. But that work is finished. It is now a formal recommendation of OASIS. It's a detailed document on assertions and assertion, the process of developing assertions and how to define them in XML. And at some point in the relatively near future, it will become a requirement for all OASIS specifications that they provide an assertion list by following these guidelines. So I'm going to include a pointer to that stuff too, which will tell you more than you ever wanted to know about test assertions. So thanks for reminding me about that, Steve. Okay, we've got about 10 minutes left. If there are questions, let's take them. So speak up if you have a question.
Yes, Al here. You didn't talk too much about ME, and there have been a couple of JSRs which, for example, like JSON, are in a position where the same JSR could be potentially running on SE and on small scale like CLDC 8 and beyond. How is that likely to happen? Does there need to be several versions of the spec?
Not necessarily. It's possible to write, let me back up a second. The section that talked about what makes a good specification doesn't say, but it's obvious. A specification should say what implementations the specification is targeted at. So certainly when you submit a JSR, you say, which platform are you aiming for? Most people will say only one. Often they will say, I'm aiming for Java SE, but I expect that this would also run on EE. As Vern is suggesting now, particularly as the smaller devices get bigger, we're increasingly likely to see specs say, I'm targeting primarily SE, but you could also implement on ME. So the spec itself can be written in such a way that it targets more than one platform. But the tricky thing then comes in writing a TCK for each platform, because basically under the process you have an obligation to provide not only TCK but an RI. Typically these environments are different enough that you will need to provide two RIs, one for each of the platforms that you claim that your spec can support, and because the TCKs typically are very different, you're probably going to have to write two TCKs. So it's a non-trivial effort to say this spec is targeted at more than one platform. To get around that, people may well say, I'm targeting this for SE at some point in the future. Maybe it will run on ME. I had a question recently internally from someone dealing with this, and they said, you know, what's our obligation? We have a spec. We're saying we're targeting SE. We're saying it may also run on ME. What are we going to do? I said, well, you know, if you want to say that it will, that it is possible to implement this spec on another platform, you can't prove that without writing the RI and the TCK. So, you know, if you don't want to do that up front, then you better say may and wait and see if someone comes and asks you for a version that works on those platforms, and then at that point you'd have to develop the RI and TCK. So it's a big job. Developing any TCK is a big job. It costs you as much as developing the RI. I estimated that the JCK, we had spent somewhere between 500 and 1,000 staff years since the beginning of time in developing the JCK, probably about 500 staff years' worth of effort. One time, my team was like 35 people. A lot of effort, and that was just my team, not the testers who tested it, and on and on and on. So it's a big deal. Okay, any other questions?
Okay, so you mentioned multiple RIs, at least multiple flavors of RIs, are not impossible for those iterations.
Right, indeed.
That's what I... Okay, great, thanks.
Any other questions? Last chance.
Yeah, hello, this is Dan Allen from Red Hat.
Hey,
I have a question.
Yeah, sure.
Hey. So several times you had mentioned how important it is to communicate, you know, what type of coverage you have, where your tests cover the spec very well, perhaps where there are deficiencies, and the importance of collecting feedback when those tests are not, you know, when they're not good enough or when they're not really doing a good job in some area. How important do you feel that having TCKs which are open are important to the success of a spec? Because it seems like you're implying that, you know, if we could see what these tests were, we could have a conversation about them.
This is a politically charged question, as I'm sure you're aware. I don't speak for Oracle. I speak for the JCP. I can answer the question generally and say that there is a broad, as you're well aware, broad opinion within the software development community that being able to see sources is better than not being able to see sources, and being able to hack on sources is better than not being able to hack on sources. So Oracle Sun and Oracle TCKs have always been open to the extent that sources were distributed to the licensees who were running them. So that if you're responsible for running a test, for running a test suite against an implementation, you get all the sources, and you know we expect you to, when you run into a problem, to poke around in the sources and to, you know, figure this stuff out. What Sun and Oracle have not done historically, and still have not done, is to open source the test suites themselves. This was done, I guess, primarily because they felt, certainly in the early days, there was a proprietary interest and value in the tests themselves, and also concerns, which to some extent are valid, about the possibility of forks or multiple competing test suites emerging from that process. So all I can say is that consensus still has not been reached within Oracle to change this position. Although the GCP itself doesn't take a position on this, and many JSRs led by non-Oracle spec leads are developed through open source processes, including the TCKs. So long answer, short answer, yes, it's important to be able to see the tests, and even when the TCK is released in quote-unquote closed source form, proprietary form, and as I'd said, one reason for that is the amount of money that Oracle's invested in these. 500 staff years is a lot of money. So they obviously considered that the JCK had significant value. But those who get it do get the sources, and without the sources, it would not be that much use to them.
Yeah. Patrick, I'll say something to that point too. The CTF is much, much larger than an individual JSR that is done, and to open source the development of the TCK would just slow down the process. It's slow enough as it is because the CTF is being developed at the same time as the RI, and things get out of sync, and it would slow down the process. But I do agree that once it's complete and once it's gone final, that it should have all the source with it, and our CTF does. So it makes it easier for somebody implementing their own implementation. They can actually see the source of the test to help them troubleshoot what's going on with it.
Yep.
But open source and the development of the TCK,
right,
or at least for the CTS, I think would just slow down the process, which is already slow.
Yeah, I agree with you. If we had an open source development process for the JCK, it would never get finished.
Yeah.
One more point I should make. We did make changes in JCP 2.8, that was JSR 348, there was language before that, and this language was typically used only by Sun and Oracle in their TCK licenses, which was very kind of secretive. It basically said to implementers. We're going to give you the sources to the TCKs, but we don't want you discussing the testing process with anybody else. You must keep this proprietary. And because, to go back to your question, Dan, you know, is this the most efficient way to make sure we have high-quality TCKs and high-quality implementations? No, it isn't. Particularly when people are doing implementation development in an open-source manner, they need to be able to communicate with each other. So we explicitly wrote language into the process document saying the TCK license must not prohibit, or rather must permit implementers to freely discuss the testing process, to discuss test failures, and to the extent that is necessary to do that, to exchange snippets of the tests themselves with other implementers and developers. So in other words, we recognize that the community of developers working in a particular area on a particular spec need to be able to talk to each other about the testing process and exchange their test results and say, I'm seeing a problem in this area. Are you seeing it? I failed this test. Oh, I didn't, but maybe it's because my implementation does this and yours does that, or I think this test is buggy. What do you think? All of those conversations, which used to be prohibited, are now, we explicitly say, must be permitted. Okay.
So just to clarify, was that that communication was between implementers, could it involve the public, though? I mean, would they have to have that conversation on a personal level?
No, I think we've said that just that that's not practical. So, you know, that would be saying, then we'd be stepping into your business and mandating the communication channels that you must use. We recognize that that, you know, when people are doing open source development processes, they're doing it in an open manner. And so, no, I don't think it prohibits that. I don't think it says you must do this in a private conversation.
Very good.
Okay. All right. I think we're at the end of the hour. So glad I had the chance to do this. This is a topic near and dear to my heart. I've been preaching about compatibility testing for years, long before I became involved directly with the JCP, and I'm going to continue to do this. We're going to continue to try and improve these training materials. Give us feedback. Tell us what works and what doesn't. Help us figure out where we should put our effort into improving them. I think we better stop. Thank you all for attending. This call is being recorded and will be put up on the JCP.org multimedia page within a few days. Thank you all. You want to turn off, Heather?